We are celebrating the birthday of Nikola Tesla. We're going old school. Phone calls all night long. Our next guest, Tim Eaton. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Coast to Coast AM. We are celebrating the birthday, 160, of Nikola Tesla. Our next guest, Tim Eaton, has worked at ILM Lucasfilms for 15-plus years on such movies as Deep Impact, Back to the Future, Galaxy Quest, The Mummy, Forrest Gump, and even Titanic. He is currently finishing a new screenplay about the life of Tesla, and I would like to welcome the Coast, Tim Eaton. Tim, how are you tonight?
Hi, good, thanks. Great.
You know, Tim, the first question out of the gate has to be, why hasn't the definitive film on Tesla been made yet? Because it has all the elements, right? It's got industrial money. It's got death rays. It's all there. Why hasn't it been made yet?
Well, that's probably the most perplexing question of the day, frankly. I mean, many people have given it a go, and you see they've made movies about, you know, people from Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, recently is coming out. So we're just basically trying to do something along the lines of what David Lean did back in the day with Dr. Zhivago, a sweeping epic, you know, with the cusp of the modern era.
And how is your screenplay focused? Because you can go in so many different areas with Tesla, it could be a sweeping epic, but then you have the science fiction side, you have the practical side and the pragmatic side. How are you guys going to focus the screenplay?
Well, we started off pretty simply by going with Mark Cipher, obviously, is the definitive author of Wizard, The Life and Times of Nikola Tesla. And so there's basically a three-act formulation of the dramatic impediments he encountered, which were namely the conflict with Tom Edison, AC/DC, and then the radio Marconi, and then the robber baron era with J.P. Morgan. So it has a basic narrative layout from historical material that sort of lends itself to a through line. The difficulty with Tesla is that he, you know, his career spans so many times and so many areas of research that trying to focus on one particular thing is difficult, but it's really about who was this guy and why did he do this stuff? Why was he driven? Why did he persist? And why are we talking about him now?
And that's the exact question. So I have to throw that directly at you. Why was he so driven? What drove Tesla?
Well, I guess there's a certain level of implicit religiosity, I suppose, because he came from a background with a father and he was expected to become a cleric, if you're familiar with the story. And I'm sure
pretty much
everybody is at this point. It's pretty well known that he came from an area of conflict, historical, military and religious turmoil, and he was sort of at the place where so much was going on, ferment, that's the word. So when he was ill and he had this vision of the future that he, you know, started to get these visions and these flashes and these premonitions and these visualizations of thoughts and machines, and he wanted to become an engineer. When you think about it, if you're on your deathbed, and you tell your father you want to become an engineer and not a priest, that's a pretty strange
situation.
But basing it on the fact that he had the Serbian sensibility of the sacrifices they'd made on the frontier of civilization, the Ottoman Empire and the clash of empires that rolled through there for so many thousands of years. So I think he basically was carrying a torch of some type of, you know, mission. He was imbued with a sense of giving back to humanity, seeing the suffering of the war that he went into the hills to avoid being drafted into the military. So I think it's a very deep motivational thing that someone, you know, sees a future that they can contribute something, and when they start rolling on it, they just don't want to stop. I mean, the oatmeal, Matt Inman did this greatest geek who ever lived, and he's a prototypical geek, and geek culture now rules. Let's face it, you know, the future is geekdom.
Why do you think it was that he allowed so many people to take advantage of him? Because when he arrived in the United States and he goes to Edison for employment, he was taken advantage of. And every step after that, it seemed like he didn't either learn his lesson or that he was just passive, because everybody just took advantage of this guy.
Well, there's part of that is, you know, he didn't have a wingman. Like, if you look at Apple with Steve Jobs and Wozniak, even though Jobs wasn't necessarily the greatest reliable person for some stories I've heard. But at the end of the day, he was sort of cut adrift and on his own. He didn't really have a posse, as it were. And you have to admit, you know, Westinghouse didn't really do him over like some other people did. He was, you know, gullible to a certain extent, I would suppose. When he came, he saw, you know, stars in his eyes. Edison was the wizard of Menlo Park. And how would you turn down something that, you know, Tom Edison, you know, was the shining beacon on the hill of industry and invention, known around the world. So, you know, I guess the joke about the $50,000 bonus is, you know, typical of that sort of story. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think he believed in the humanity. He said money was not really what he was all about. And he used his money to try and uplift the condition of humanity. So he was, it's almost a saintly thing. There is a, you know, a movement to have him sanctified as a saint afoot over the years. And he was actually on a mission from God, in a sense, to steal from the Blues Brothers.
With his visions of the future, where do you think that came from? Because it wasn't only the free electricity or wireless power, wireless lighting. There was that aspect of it. But certainly when you go move so far forward into death rays and anti-gravity, at that time, that was pure science fiction. And yet he pursued this. Where did this vision of the future come from?
Well, I mean, you have to, one of the things he said he loved books best when he was a kid, and when you look at the correspondence, I saw some of the letters he had in the library in New York City, some of the microfilm, the correspondence. I mean, he probably had a pretty good sensibility of current events and other research going on, and H.G. Wells, of course, the idea of life on Mars and the canals was current at that time. So he was on the cusp of the interplanetary consciousness of the cosmos, and then he had the experience with the Swami, which gave him the idea of Hindu mysticism and the prana and the energy, the cosmic etheric. So what was the question again?
Well, yeah, I mean, where did these grand visions come from? Because he turned it from science fiction into practical applications.
Well, you know, where the visions came from is a really good question. I mean, he did talk about when he was younger having these events where he would travel multidimensionally, in effect, where he would go and visit people in other lands, and they were as real to him as real people in his life. So he was and he did say his brain was a receiver from the cosmos. So there's a lot of research in the mind going on right now about the physicality and the connectivity of the, as various people say, that humanity is a universe learning about itself by our experiences. So maybe there's a feedback loop there. So at the end of the day, you know, he was very focused on extrapolation, I think, to a certain extent. He saw where you could take one thing and then take it to the next level and the next level. So probably sort of a feedback loop, I would imagine.
Did he, there were rumors that he, of course he had the remote controlled boat, but that he had developed a remote controlled and wireless torpedo. What can you tell me about that?
Well, I think you spoke to Mark Cipher previously, possibly. He was working, you know, with the War Department, and it's kind of a conflicted story, really, when you think about it. On one hand, he wrote an article, A Machine to End War, which was basically Teleforce, which he, I think, called the Peace Ray, and then it became known in the press as the Death Ray. And if you look at the history of the Nobel Peace Prize, Alfred Nobel developed TNT as an explosive to make war too hideous to contemplate. So at the end of the day, he was very, I think, conflicted with, the torpedoes. I think we're like a standoff concept where if people know that you could, destroy shipping, from subterfuge, that it would, be another way to perhaps make war unthinkable. Why would someone, torpedo the Lusitania? It's just like the horrific level was beyond belief. But now, people have become adapted to the horror that it's just run of the mill these days, frankly.
Yeah, right. And Tim, what do you think his greatest contribution is going to be when we look back in 50 years?
Well, I hope we make it to 50 years. The thing that he tried to do, I think, in a certain sense, was save us from ourselves. And there's a lot of stuff on the internet about, him basically. At one point, I think there's a website called Upworthy, and they call him the only man on the planet that could say, "I told you so," which is basically at a level he was concerned about the consumption of fossil fuels, not just from exhaustion of the source and supply, but also the detrimental, fumes and corruption of the atmosphere. So I think he was a man ahead of his time, pointing us in a direction that the moneyed interests found unpalatable to their orientation. If you're threatening JP Morgan's copper investments and you're going to be able to, do a end run around that methodology of electricity delivery, then you're putting yourself up there to be knocked off by people in power that don't see that line of thought. So one thing he did say in the problem of increasing human energy, and he did caveat it a bit, was the forces of nature don't care what political party you are. The science of CO2 absorption, heat retention, that's not something that's negotiable. Nature does its own thing and bats last. So he was basically pointing out that we are basically living on the thin knife edge of the balance of nature.
And why, when he spent what money he did make off of his patents, he put all of that back into his own research. Why do you think that there wasn't anybody towards the end of his life, going through the beginning of World War II? Why didn't he continue to have somebody to support him when his ideas were there? Was it because that he didn't want to profit on them?
Well, look at the fact that there was the Navy board that Edison was a consultant on and called Tesla a loony, and they did a cartoon with Superman where they had this mad scientist. So he got tarred and feathered as a, as a kind of out there crackpot to a certain extent.
Right.
And it became a self-perpetuating thing to a certain extent with the pigeon fixation, which, when you think about it, there's a lot of research on the intelligence of pigeons. Maybe he was actually not just into them as a actual, hobby, but maybe he saw something about their behavior that was a reflection that he was getting some divine inspiration from. But at the end of the day, he I guess he cut. He seems like an irascible kind of fellow. Also, he was, he had this sort of highfalutin sense about himself that he worked hard for humanity and he deserved to live properly in these hotels and a lifestyle. There was a quid pro quo. He saw himself as contributing to the betterment of humanity, and he didn't really want to live in a garret and suffer. He deserved to live comfortably. I think that's a reasonable expectation. He might have taken it a bit over the top.
With the different alternative websites that are out there and conspiracy websites and so forth, when it comes to Tesla, he is held at the top for all things conspiracy about the way that he was shut down and the knowledge that was suppressed. Do you think there is something to that, in that the way that he is held in such high regard for being, the martyr for the conspiracy side of things? Is there something to that?
Well, at a certain point, I'm even, drowning in stuff on a daily basis of monitoring stuff on posts on the internet and, Reddit
Right,
and
right.
Facebook. And the fundamental thing was This was an extraordinary man doing extraordinary things for extraordinary reasons. There are all sorts of conspiracy things about aliens and the people who worship him, the Unarian Church, seeing him as an ascended higher level of existence, and the Nazi UFO anti-gravitic people. And, you know, at a certain point, you've got to sort of take it all with a grain of salt. I mean, the guy did exist. He did do real stuff. Is there extrapolatory, you know, the seizure of the papers and Trump's uncle and the FBI and alien property? There was definitely, because he had, you know, gone to Stalin and communicated with the Russians for the Teleforce as a defensive ray. I think he put himself out for being, you know, under investigation, obviously, with the FBI. There's all the files that you can see these days. So the conspiracy stuff is usually, there's actually a seed of truth to all of these concepts, it's whether you take them to an absurdist level or, you know, sort of factually try to dissect the dynamics of the situation at the time. Historically, it was a crazy, you know, you're at war for the future of civilization with the Nazis. I mean, you have to understand that the tenor of the times, I think, to contextualize where all that extrapolation comes from.
Well, you're exactly right, because the death ray, which was science fiction, to him was real, and it was a patent applied for technology. He shopped the technology. So you're right. There is a grain of truth to it. The question is, how far along was it, and why didn't we see that technology actually to be used?
Well, there's quite a few recent papers that I've read about people doing, you know, research into coherent beams and dispersion, obviously, with lasers when you hit a fog or a cloud or obscuration. So, you know, he was on to a different level of understanding, and there's a very recent videos that I saw that someone's actually gone through his actual writings and said, well, when he wrote, the problem today in current, you know, technology speak, as it were, is that words that he used then don't necessarily have a direct parallel. What he meant with three words then might be interpreted in an entirely different slant today because of the nomenclature. So, you know, at the end of the day, you have to really be someone who's more, you know, engineering inclined than I am, personally, frankly, to sort of, you know, transpose the words that he wrote and meant. And then there's also the whole thing about, I've come across where, for instance, Leonardo, I believe, or Galileo, wrote in code. So at a certain point, was he actually partially obfuscating some of this stuff?
I think that's exactly the point. And we are celebrating the 160th birthday of Nikola Tesla. Our guest right now is Tim Eaton. We're going to take your phone calls next. This is Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back. Check this out. A mysterious disc-shaped black object was filmed flying over a medieval fortress, and it has sparked a UFO probe. The UFO was spotted hovering over a medieval fortress in North Wales, and the footage shows a disc-shaped object drifting above the fort at least 40 seconds before it disappeared behind some of the turrets. You need to go and check out this video right now. It was just uploaded to YouTube, but we have it over at coasttocoastam.com. We are celebrating Nikola Tesla's 160th birthday. And we are talking with Tim Eaton. And also, you can check out his website, Tesla, The Lost Wizard. It is thetesla.movie.com. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We're taking your phone calls next with Tim Eaton. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We are celebrating the birthday of Nikola Tesla. And we're talking with Tim Eaton. And Tim, one of the things that a lot of people don't know about Tesla, but he may have invented the laser as well.
Yeah, I'm a little bit dubious on that. He was working in, you know, coherent technology, but the laser itself, you know, I wouldn't really put that as a top tier.
Right. Well, that's why I said may. But you know, it's just about his vision of the future, and that he may have been working with an application towards the technology, but he was
laser-like. Let's say laser.
Yes, laser-like. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to the wild card line. Let's go to Mike out in West Palm Beach, Florida. Welcome to Coast, Mike.
How you doing? To invest. I don't know how much research you did about it. There was speculation that he'd caused the explosion over Siberia in 1908. He had some beam weapon from Long Island. He had his transmitter there. And supposedly, he was trying to aim for the Arctic, because they had the explorers up there at that time. And he didn't want it to hit Siberia, but gravity pulled it away. But what is your opinion about your research on that area with Tunguska?
Yeah, and thank you so much for the phone call, Mike. And Tim, there's an example of legend versus myth and fact.
Well, incidentally, before I even knew about Tesla, I think I read a book about the Siberian event that they're referencing, and there's actually quite a bit of interesting, you know, space debris type research. One of the books I read said that there was actually a change in the trajectory, as if it was under some type of control. And as far as the Tesla Tunguska thing, you know, frankly, it's kind of interesting to speculate about, and possibly, I don't think Mark Cipher, my writing partner, the biographer, is too convinced that there's a lot of ability that he might have had to fire up the device for that level of projection at that time. So it's kind of one of those things that, okay, so what does that, you know, very interesting conjecture, but at the end of the day, the real legacy of Tesla is what he saw of the future that, you know, we're still trying to understand that he was thinking about.
That's exactly right. And when you have myth, legend, and what is actually fact, and what happened at Tunguska with the apparent change in trajectory, and also today the mystery of it, is that we really don't know what happened there. We don't. We have no clue.
Sure. Well, they haven't been, there were some bizarre, you know, minerals that they found, the fused crystalline pellets that's on description.
Right.
But it doesn't fit a typical meteor impact. That sort of could have been, some people even say a mini black hole, which would have had bizarre quantum characteristics. So, you know, as far as Tesla goes, I'm more of interested in who he was, what he did really, and what, you know, his vision can still affect our future, what those ramifications might turn out to be. That, for instance, I'll just go off a bit here. So one of the things he was talking about was photographing thought. And now we have the technology to actually do brain scans. And coincidentally, Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook said the future of Facebook lies in telepathy.
Right.
So photographing thought and telepathy, I mean, those are actual, you know, real-world researches that might actually be something that 5 years from now we can beam thoughts to each other to a certain degree.
Photographing thought. That is interesting. Let's go to Wildcard. Let's go to Joe out in New York. Joe, welcome to Coast.
Hey, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm doing good, Joe.
Good. Yes, I wanted to ask your guest, Tim Eaton, how many patents are credited to Tesla? And also, have there been any recent discoveries of secret diaries or journals that belong to Tesla? Can you elaborate?
Great question, Joe. Thank you. Tim?
Well, there's a number of different, you know, international patents and American patents. So I think it was like 300 American, 700 total, when you add up all the international ones. And as far, I mean, there's a lot of stuff where people find the alleged, you know, documents or things that he, interviews that he gave, which are kind of sketchy. There was apparently some fellow at one point found a fireman's helmet, and they found a document inside, and it was all these plans from his lab that burnt down that here hadn't been found before. As far as patents that, you know, people have found that he didn't necessarily register, I'm not sure about that. There are people doing research that extrapolate from the basic things that he, you know, developed the fundamental principle for, but I'm not a patent expert particularly. I mean, the fact of the matter is he did actually produce real-world devices, You know, some of them are like electric railway cars or fountain mechanisms or the speedometer. I mean, those are very pretty mundane things, which are valuable in and of themselves. And there's the more esoteric stuff, you know, which is not necessarily fringe, but is more pushing the bleeding edge, as it were.
What about diaries and secret diaries? Do you think that there's anything out there that we haven't found?
Well, that really goes down back to the seizure of material from his suite at the Hotel New Yorker, and then he had the materials, you know, a lot of it went to the museum in Belgrade, 40 trunks or so. You know, at the end of the day, I don't know if there's an actual itemized, you know, checkoff that you can say this is missing. And, I mean, one of the things I find very mystifying is how that there's such a story that he never wrote things down when, obviously, he had the Colorado Springs notes, which I don't have a copy of, but I saw a copy at the Tesla conference from the Tesla Museum. The director there is a pretty, you know, I think it even might be online now, but it's pretty comprehensive, detailed, day-by-day experimental stuff. And then the speeches and the things he wrote. I was just rereading the speech he gave for the Edison Medal that he ironically received.
Right.
There's a lot of real, you know, there's a lot of detailed reminiscence. He wrote an autobiography called My Inventions, where he details out his boyhood and the electrical experimenter. So he wrote a lot of stuff. But there's other stuff that we haven't found. I wouldn't be surprised, and there probably is. You know, I'm not sure at a certain point how could they have sorted through in such a short amount of time in his suite what they would have cherry picked. So,
yeah, there was one interesting thing, and you just mentioned it right there, and I've had trouble with this over the years, that there were 40 trunks that were sent to Budapest. And a certain amount of it was, you know, allegedly taken from agents of the United States before everything was shipped off to Budapest, which didn't even happen until, you know, a while later anyway. But where were 40 trunks of documents stored at the New Yorker? He was living in one room, wasn't he?
Well, no, he had them in a Manhattan storage company or some, you know, like one of your public storage, you know, big storage warehouses that, you know, let's face it, he had all his equipment out at Wardenclyffe, the early, you know, devices that he, the radio-controlled boat to tele-autonomy on.
Right.
And, you know, a lot of his, if you go through, there's actually a piece of material I found, which is his testimony for the mortgage on the property.
That's right.
He does an explicit listing of what was in what room and how many cabinets and what kinds of tubes he had there and what the voices he was working in, coils and capacitors and attenuators. So, you know, the fact of the matter is he left sort of a debris trail of materials and equipment. And, you know, some of it's been seized and stolen and, you know, just otherwise disappeared into, you know, various private parties. I've heard rumors that people have, you know, absconded with some of his equipment, and it's privately maintained, you know, the way stuff disappears.
Do you ask for information about Tesla? If anybody out there knows anything or has anything, do you request that information?
Well, I've been probably mostly working directly with Mark Cipher, who did all of the diligent work back in the 80s and onwards, you know, writing his definitive biography. So at this point, I'm pretty much chock-a-block with, you know, so many details and minutiae that I'm not really absorbing.
Right. I can only imagine, because I was looking at your website over the last couple of days, and I was just wondering how much information comes flooding in via that website about Tesla and how you sort through it.
Well, at a certain point, I'm sort of a passive, just grazing over stuff that I see posted, especially today with the birthday celebrations. There was a event in near Toronto where they renamed a boulevard after him, and then there was celebration in Belgrade, and at Wardenclyffe, they were live streaming from his lab there. So,
right, I saw that.
I can barely keep up just with the general day-to-day, you know, events and people. My focus really has been writing a lot more and more, frankly. Besides the screenplay, which we discussed earlier on, we've actually gone and attacked the project as if it was going to be a mini-series. So there isn't just one script which tells one part of the story. There's numerous standalone scripts which then all feed into like a 20-hour Boardwalk Empire type HBO show. So
right, right.
The thing is, the material is so, you can take a nub of one piece of information that he did this, and then I sort of, Mark is like the fact guy and I'm kind of the extrapolation guy. So I try and, you know, when he was at the World Fair in 1893, did he go on the Ferris wheel with someone? So we wrote a scene where he's on the Ferris wheel. So at a certain point, a movie is more than the facts. It's sort of a, you've got to have the entertainment aspect in it. So we've tried to take the story of his reality, but also give it that fantastical, you know, above and beyond quality to it.
Yeah, and as you should. Let's go east of the Rockies. Scott in Oskaloosa. Scott, you're up next on Coast.
Yeah, hi, Jimmy. And the guest you get on now is, I mean, I think he's doing a great job because Tesla was a genius. We all know that, but he wasn't a superhuman. Come on. You know, and I think that that's what this gentleman you have on now is trying to explain. But wonderful things he did. Madame Curie, hey, I wouldn't be able to talk to you on your cell phone without her. But what my question is more about his life. The question I have is, and I'll take my answer directly off there. This man believed in God or a creator, and that's that simple. So have a great night, gentlemen.
Yeah, thank you so much, Scott. Tim, what about that?
Well, he did have a quote that I've seen pretty extensively that his mother told him that all creative vitality comes from God, and obviously with a Christian, Greek Orthodox, rather, background with a priest, I think he was pretty well imbued with a religiosity, but I think he was probably one of the bleeding edge universalists. If there is such a word.
There is.
He was getting more into the cosmic appreciation of the unity of man. He said, you know, peace can come through universal enlightenment. So I don't think he was necessarily a dogmatic theology, towing the line on the details of the written scripture. I think he was more someone who lived by the tenets of living a higher calling was his religion, I think.
So are you suggesting that later on in his life he was moving more towards being an atheist and was moving away from the religion that his father wanted him to follow?
I don't think he was necessarily a theological religious person. I think he was a spiritual person that
right.
was motivated by a fundamental appreciation of the tenets of, you know, do unto others and live a righteous life. I don't think he was necessarily someone who was, you know, quoting scriptures.
I don't sure.
think that in any of his writings where he actually does a recitation of Job's 11 or some particular, you know, saying from the Bible or any other, you know, written scripture. He did talk, you know, about the prana, and he did get exposure to, you know, world religion, the World Congress of Religions, which was held, you know, concurrently with the Chicago World Exposition of 1893. That was a big exposure of America to other, you know, theological thought. It was almost like the Kabbalah, that Madonna and all these celebrities were following for a certain point of time. The Swamis were a ripple effect. And so I think he was in a potpourri. It was a melting pot of America. So I think he was exposed to a lot of things and was like a sponge.
One last quick call. We're going to go to Howard up here in Vancouver, Washington. Quickly say happy birthday to Nikola Tesla, Howard.
Okay, happy birthday, Nikola. Good to talk to you, Jimmy and Tim. During the Second World War, there was a rather famous actress. She was Austrian-born. Name was Hedy Lamarr.
Oh, yeah, we know about Hedy.
And She had a double life, unknown to most people. She was a brilliant engineer, and she had developed a remotely controlled torpedo that had initially been rejected by the Navy, but later, after the war, was accepted. And since Nikola Tesla was working on the same kind of a project, I wonder if there was any kind of an association between those two.
That's a great question, Howard, and thank you for the phone call. Do you think Nikola knew Hedy Lamarr?
Gosh, that would be a great screenplay, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm just thinking the same thing.
I don't recollect that there's any historical recording of such a thing. She was working on spread spectrum.
Yeah, and she was a packet switching, right.
Yeah, so frequency hopping. So at the end of the day, you know, they were working on the same conceptual general proposition, but I don't think necessarily the nuts and bolts were necessarily, you know, similarly. I haven't really examined that particular detail work myself, but, you know, fundamentally people were trying to find new ways of controlling remote control, you know, was a bleeding edge thing at that point.
It was amazing how smart she really was. Mm-hmm. I mean, we wouldn't have cell phones today, or the packet switching idea of frequency hopping, and the vision of that coming from her was absolutely groundbreaking. Now, what's next?
All of these scientists are on the shoulders of other people. Nobody's working in isolation. The contributions add up, and then they have a flashpoint.
Yep. Yep, you're absolutely right. Hey Tim, what's next for the screenplay? When can we expect something?
Well, we're working on it actually on a daily basis with calls and pitches and people in LA and New York and Canada. You know, fundamentally Mark is speaking in New York on Lexington Avenue at the hotel on Wednesday, and we've got 50 or so people attending, and we've sent out invitations to people in the movie business in New York. So at the end of the day, you know, it's perplexing that there's been so much disinterest, frankly. On one hand, there's a lot of people who have tried to do Tesla movies. On the other hand, there's people that say it's not doable. So it's just got to keep on pitching.
You just keep rolling that rock uphill. And thank you so much for coming on tonight. Great conversation and helping us celebrate the birthday of Nikola Tesla. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. This is Coast to Coast AM. Your phone calls next. We're going old school. Stay with us.